The old astrologers, back in the times of Ptolemy and the beginnings of Chaldean astrological research, divided the seven ages of man between the then known planets, and to cover everything above the age of 70, they said Saturn rules from then to the end of life. This is subject to some modifications, however, and it seems to me that the answer is that we will have to recalculate the period after 70. I think we should begin by saying from 71 to 80, the individual is under the rulership of Uranus. From 81 to 90, Neptune. And from 91 to 100, Pluto. In other words, we need to include these others in our calculating for the simple reason that human life expectancy at the present time brings these influences to bear upon ever more human beings who may survive into the 80s, 90s, and even reach 100. So to cover all of this, it becomes necessary to assign various significant activities to those older years, rather than to simply sum them up and say from Saturn on is the end. It isn't the end anymore. And we have to begin to evaluate the life of the person who has passed through the old Chaldean cycle. Actually, the problem of what to do with life after retirement from active occupations is now becoming very important, because more and more persons have anywhere from 10 to 20 or 25 year life expectancy after retirement from business, or the responsibilities that have held their attention during their important economic years. Now, when we come to study this, we try to think out what man is really concerned with in life. And we find that to the average person, life is simply a process of continuing to supply oneself and one's families with the necessities of material existence. In other words, it's a workday world, either physical labor or mental labor, through the productive years of our economic existence. Yet actually, we must realize that the process of making a living in this physical environment is possibly the least important aspect of our existence. From a physical standpoint, yes, it is necessary. But beyond that point, we have to remember that anything that we accumulate in this world must stay behind when we leave. And if we have nothing to take with us, the question is, how important a life have we actually experienced? Have we done anything that can go forward except perhaps a moral quality of having been as honest as conditions permitted? This means that there is some other reason for life than merely paying for the food we eat and the housing that shelters it. We have to have something that develops within ourselves. The advancement of the person is also an important part of living. And this is generally summed up in the term experience. The things we experience in life become very important to us as we grow older. But if by any chance we have had a melancholy nature, we can wipe out the value of experience if it has been against our general happiness or our desires. We can forget it or consider it a loss. Actually, however, experience is the thing that is most important in the life that we live. We are here to learn through experience. This is exactly the opposite of what has become considered to be an adage of importance. a slogan by which to live. And the goes something like this: if I want it, I will have it. If I don't want it, I won't accept it. Now, on this arbitrary basis, pleasure, comfort, personal satisfaction at the moment, evasion of responsibility, and a certain plaudit or overtone of success, these become the important factors in life. The result is that we have very, very little to work with. Now, quite often we come across people in various conditions of what we might term a maturity of living. The individual who reaches retirement age may take as a slogan, "I'm through with work. Now I'm going to enjoy myself. Don't ask me to do anything I do not want to do." That sounds pretty good if you can get away with it. But has the individual an answer for that part of his own statement, namely that he is going to try and be happy? He is going to try to do the things he has always wanted to do. He is going to use his advancing years to really do what has been on his heart and mind since the beginning, and which probably has been blocked by economic necessities. With at least 15, maybe 25, or even 30 years of reasonable activity possible to him, what is he going to do with this time? Most people seemingly do not make much use of it, because when they reach retirement, they have a sudden break in their life pattern. All of a sudden, the busy individual has nothing to do. He may be on a comfortable pension or Social Security, but he has nothing to do that he has long done and about which he has habits and skills. He suddenly finds himself with a future that is completely uncharted. And we see what people do with this future, and sometimes it's a little pathetic. One group will settle down to play canasta for the rest of their lives, and they will be able to fill up almost every moment of their waking hours with trivia that means nothing, which they are not even going to think about. Another individual group or group will decide to travel, but they may be unprepared for travel and may find it a little too much of an exertion after a while. They are trying to fulfill a certain type of frustration. They've always wanted to do different things and visit different places. Another group simply sits quietly in front of the television and lets the television make the noise. And it does. And they watch every program carefully and feel that they are having what they've always looked forward to: the pleasure of doing nothing. Others move in on family. They find an effort to control their descendants. They want to influence the lives of their children and grandchildren, perhaps more than is best. After all, such interference is largely finding something to do that seems to be important. Then there are a few who try to improve their mental lives. They have decided, as an old friend of mine once decided, that they might be many people speaking Spanish in the years ahead, so he might as well learn now and know it when he comes back in his next embodiment. This is a long struggle for what he thinks he wants to do. Then there are those who join various maturity occupations. They take bus drives to Death Valley. They have picnics. They do all kinds of things. Perhaps they have a competitive tatting exhibition or make bed quilts. No one knows what they're going to do, but they're filling up time, because to them there is no particular future, and they are no longer responsible to society, which is now becoming responsible for them. So things drift until nature, in its due course, produces a coronary or a hardening of the arteries. This is a very serious waste of energy and time. It is definitely an inexcusable lack of planning. The individual who has every reason to expect he has a future should do something about it. And even if he shouldn't live to do all the things he's planned, the decision to do instead of to wait, the determination to grow instead of to gradually go to seed, these changes of attitudes are very important, not only for the pleasure of the person, but for the actual extent of his life years. It has been proven on countless occasions that the individual who has a particular plan is more likely to last long enough to fulfill it than a person who has no plan and therefore has no real reason for existence. The time to consider all these matters, of course, is as early as your mind can get fixed on them. Some people are now beginning to realize that it is important to plan a future. And those metaphysically inclined, who believe in reincarnation, who have a desire to recognize a compensatory principle in nature, will do better than those without this. The individual who does not know what is going to happen to him afterwards, if anything, is not nearly as likely to make a good and constructive choice as the individual who believes firmly that he is eternal and is here to grow. Now, if he has this kind of a philosophy, it is also good for him to study his own nature, as psychologists have discovered. Nearly everyone has a dominant and a subdominant interest in life. When you go to the university, you generally select a dominant and also a subdominant in education. You may decide you want to be a banker, but you want something else besides, so you take a course in language or in art or in literature to balance the one intensity that you have selected. Now, in living, the same problem is very necessary. We must have a subdominant from the beginning in order to achieve a good life. Now, the Wall Street Journal probably wouldn't advise this. They feel that when you're in business or working, you must give everything you have and are to it. You must think of nothing else. You must spend all your time knowing more and more about the one job you have. And if you can forget everything else, often including your own family, you may get to be president of the corporation in due time. If not, you will retire with a chime clock, large, handsome one, with a label on it bearing your name. You are supposed to be one-pointed in order to succeed. But this is the kind of success that you cannot take with you. It is little difficult to believe, even by any religious doctrine, that an individual who has given everything he has to banking is prepared for a universal existence in which banking is of no consequence whatsoever. The answer is, of course, the Egyptian idea of the person who was earthbound. When the broker was earthbound and died, they gave him a table and a chair in front gate of paradise. And he was there to change money, make accounts, set up banking for all the spirits that came by. Of course, they had nothing to give him to deposit. He had nothing to accept and no place to put it. But everybody lived in a kind of a dream life, fulfilling their common expectancies. The Egyptians proved conclusively, however, that this particular way of life was ineffective. So having realized the importance of divided interest, it is very important that if a person is in an artistic field, that he develop some type of intellectual interest. If he is in an intellectual field, he should work for aesthetics or some branch of learning that will balance his major activity. Now, he may say that he has no time for this. Well, nature took that into consideration also. And very often, when the person marries, the spouse will have an alternate interest. The interest of the family can become important to the individual. He can find that perhaps he is devoted to a shop or a store, but the wife is interested in music or language or in art, and the sharing of this secondary interest can become important. And as the individuals grow older and their materialistic interests lessen, they have found something in common besides merely the everyday existence which people live by. So one way or another, it is advisable to try to locate a field of compensatory activity to balance the things that we commonly do. This is one of the problems that is being revealed clearly in the program of Women's Lib. The woman who has been a housekeeper, a mother, a parent, finds it important to have other activities. The children grow up. The world which occupied her completely, maybe for 20 years, suddenly is not sufficient. And long before retirement, by age, she is looking for a new outlet, something that will give her a reason for existence when the more intimate things have gradually faded away. So she is out and finds herself a housewife who is suddenly a senator, a judge, or an executive in business. This is the compensation again from an emotional to a mental level. Generally speaking, with men, the best compensations are from a mental to an emotional or aesthetic level, or from some form of self-improvement which can produce results almost immediately. Many of the most important people in the world would never have had a reputation at all had they died at 65. Their careers began after that. They did many interesting things which earlier life fitted them to do, but did not necessarily demand the doing. The most important first decision, probably, is to stop looking at retirement as a time of doing nothing and the happiness of indolence. There is no happiness in indolence. It is simply a gratification of a poor attitude and becomes a bad habit. Looking, therefore, to find out what we might do, I would say that the person should have the modifying or secondary interest awake in himself by the time he's 30 or 35 years old. He should begin to discover what he needs to be a complete person. In the past, we have had various outlets for this particular problem of ourselves. The greatest modifying influence in the life of the majority of human beings has been religion. This was something that could not be completely dominated by materialistic concerns. It was the emotional outlet for many, many millions of people. Today, however, this is not as dominant an outlet as it was in the old times. Today, religion is a very important compensating attitude or research project. And as the person reaches retirement, he may give greater and greater study to this subject. But if it looks like this is going to help him, then early in life he should begin to qualify his religious instincts and make them important in his life, and useful and constructive, and escape the dangers that fall to many people in religion in older years, and that is bigotry or fanaticism. The answer to that, of course, is that the religion of older years must be well settled in the consciousness by a study of comparative religion, by an understanding of religion's place in conduct, and by the gradual modifying of personal conduct to keep within the pattern of religious ethics. All these things can be considered. Another final point in connection with this is the importance of the arts as a contrast to the sciences. The scientist is probably one of the worst offenders in the problem of limited interests. He is a biologist, and everything in his life is biology. He is astronomy, and he measures people and world conditions and everything by the galaxy. He is concerned in mathematics, and mathematics becomes an obsession. And in higher intellectualism, it is easy for the attitudes of the peer group, the great scientific group, to cause the person to become hopelessly involved in bad mental habits. He will do everything possible to stay within the boundaries of his scientific viewpoint. He will reject things that conflict with science, although they may be true. He will overlook a great part of the warmth and beauty of life while he is studying advanced mathematics or the history of the monad. He is always inclined to make his mental occupation his vacation preoccupation. He does not face the importance of variety, of contrast, and things of that nature. A few have done, however, a rather good job in maintaining interests. One of the most common interests of science is music. It is in this area that they seem to find the greatest possibility of a compensatory outlet. The music is probably selected largely because it is not argumentative. It is not something that you are going to be able to break down, tear apart, and do something with from a scientific viewpoint. Music is an expression. It is true that it has to be skilled. The individual has to practice and learn. But it becomes a tremendously important expression on a world level that is not tied up with mathematics and physics. A great example, of course, of this was Einstein, who was more or less a competent violinist. He says less, others thought more. But the great concert that Einstein ever gave was in a small hotel where there were only a half a dozen people present, and you will never guess who his accompanist on the piano was. Durante. And he said he wasn't so good, too. But they had a big time together. Jimmy Durante, accompanying Einstein on the piano. They both had a good time. It was important. And these outlets are not only things to give fun and pleasure, but they require hard work to accomplish a creditable level of performance. Music is excellent. If music is not so good, we can go to the banker who has spent his whole life accumulating funds, handling them, and we hope not absconding with them. But anyway, what does the retired banker do? Well, one of the most common things that Andrew Carnegie did was build libraries. He found his outlet in that area. Another one collected art, music. Mellon, the great authority on aluminum, collected classic bindings and things of this nature in rare books and manuscripts. Every one of these mental specialists instinctively had the realization that he wasn't sufficient and did not have a full life. Now, many women have taken the attitude that their children is their hobby. I've had that told to me a number of times when I brought the subject up with distraught mothers of one type or another. A child is not a hobby. A child is a career. And those who do it well have done a great deal, but the child will grow up. And when you try to control it too long, you get into trouble. There comes a life point in every mother where she has to shift her emotions away from her children and towards something else. Now, on these conditions, the secondary interest becomes very, very important. She may turn to business or to science after the children have left the nest. But in order to succeed in any of these things, the mother must have started a little earlier to decide what she was going to do. It's quite a shock to suddenly be forced to take up a subject you've never thought of before. It is far better from the very beginning to estimate what you're going to do when the job you're doing is finished. If you can do this, you will have more people who are no longer thinking of themselves as through, simply because one interest or one responsibility has been taken away. In philosophy, in these fields of which we are especially interested, the thought dominates that there is a tremendous world of information and interest in the various ideals of humankind. One of the points, then, to work on is to build our own internal stability. While we're busy morning, noon, and night, and maybe headed for ulcers and a breakdown, it is difficult to establish personal stability. It is difficult to get past the point of worrying to death over things that essentially will never be improved by worry. It is necessary, consequently, for the individual to make in his business adjustments a good or orderly approach to life, and when the business life is finished, continue to live in an orderly manner. This means that the life principle must be big enough to include both work and rest. The individual must learn to rest constructively just as he worked constructively. He must never think retirement is the end of anything. It is a shift of emphasis from a subdominant to another level to release the inner potential of the person and help that person to be so busy that they forget to grow old. This is a very valuable point. We have all kinds of sad tales of persons who have finished a business career. They visit their children and finally decide the children really don't need them, and in some cases are frankly say they don't. They try to find some interest in some form of education, but they're not very well fitted for it. Then they begin to look perhaps closer to the fact, and that is to find ways of helping other people. The greatest side career that anyone can have is helpfulness. A sympathy, an understanding, an ability to rise above criticism, to rise above all the false values that lead to misunderstanding, and be able to help people. When you do not know what else to do, forget yourself and help a person whose need is greater than yours. Actually, therefore, we find a lot of people doing this simply because it is very important to them. But very many of them reach the age of wanting to be helpful with very little skill or experience in the matter. It is difficult for them to help except within the area of their own personal experience. They can help people whose problems have been the same as their own. Other people, it's more difficult to help. So, at the beginning of this pre-retirement philosophy, we start figuring out how to help people long before we take on that career. Or we may dabble in it a little, but a disappointment or two should never frustrate us. But we should begin to think in terms of learning all that we can that will help us to help others. If we have experiences in life in which things we have done have helped others, this is the beginning of a very important career. The average person who reaches 65 in reasonably good health has already taken the most important course in psychology that has ever been given, his own life. If he hasn't learned from that, he's in bad trouble. But he has learned, but it has never occurred to him that he was going to do with anything except store it away in himself. He very often goes his entire length of life without sharing the values of a few important experiences through which he has passed. Sometimes he says nobody cares, but that is not true. There's always someone who cares. And with the world in its present condition, the need for genuine, unselfish, informed helpfulness is very great. But to be an informed helper, you have to have information. You have to have started earlier. You have to pass through certain disillusionments and not be like one person I know who, having thought of nothing but themselves until retirement, suddenly decided they wanted to be a philanthropist. They really wanted to go out and help people. So the person they first helped cheated them out of everything they had. This was really a bad experience, but a very informative one. This person, in order to be helpful, had to have the skill to protect himself and the wisdom to direct and assist others. The only way to do it is to start with your own background. Find out what has happened to you, how it could have been better, how you could have avoided problems, and instead of blaming people who have hurt you, start trying to learn what you should have done about it long before it happened. All this type of thing gets us past that point that is mentioned by King Lear, who says it is sharper than a serpent's tooth to have a thankless child. And that's true. But we should learn these things in time to know what to do about it, or to plan a career in which that child could not help but be thankful because of the skill and wisdom with which we administered their lives while they were in our responsibility. So there's always this problem of getting ready for this new program that is to come. I think that the average person with some limitations will not find it practical to try to forget life by traveling all the time. Good trips, fine. Occasional journeys to a place you've always wanted to go to can be tremendously important. But to use it simply to get away from yourself, remember always that no matter where you go, you're always with yourself. You're the one person you can't get away from. Actually, also, travel must have meaning. I remember, as I think I've told before, about the tour in which the ship with its wonderful cargo of people was anchored off the city of Athens. And in the lounge, the bridge tournaments were going full rate at that time. So one of the people who said to the guard, tour guide, said, "Is it worthwhile for us to go to shore to look at these old ruins? After all, we are in the third game of a very important bridge tournament. And I think we're going to win." And the guide said with great seriousness, "I would advise you to stay right with the bridge. Don't interfere with it." A person who was more interested in bridge than seeing the great glory of the Greek culture should stay there. But probably, if the truth were known, he should have stayed at home. It would have saved money and been the same, and he could have had his bridge tournaments as he always had them. So unless there is a reason, unless a trip fulfills a secret hope, a purpose, a determination, unless it ties with attitudes towards life, the journey will sanction or support. There's very little outlet. Again, travel is a sophisticated career. And to make anything out of it, you must want to go where you go. And you must learn something, and you must go because you want to learn something. Just to waste time at the ship's bar is no particular value to anyone concerned. So the matter of making something out of the older years is based largely on what has been built up in younger years. Now, this is a fascinating world. Everything in it is of interest to somebody. And many persons find a tremendous relaxation in the examination of nature's processes. I think one of the best programs that we have on television these days are the programs that are made up of nature studies. Studies of places and peoples and things, and not fiction. Because the fact is far more interesting, remarkable, and informative, and helps to give us a new dimension of sight. As we step out of the old dimension of job, we must step into a new dimension of insight. we must be looking forward to those years and days as the opportunities for the best things we've ever done and the fulfillment of the deepest and most noble of our impulses and instincts. If this is the case, then we will begin looking forward to a systematically organized retirement. A retirement in which there will be no break in our activity and no burden upon other people. One of the problems with the retirement of men is that the first time in their lives, they're home all the while. And the wife finds suddenly that a life that has been largely in her own keeping, as particularly in the daylight period, where she has been doing as she pleased, shopping, visiting, suddenly finds herself at home, tied to a sulky elderly man who has nothing on his mind except business. This type of situation isn't fair to either person, and whichever one is in this sulking mood or is sitting around waiting for his arteries to harden is no companion. A great loss of intimacy and personal relationships threatens, and it's astonishing how many elderly people divorce or separate simply because they were happy together when they were busy, but they were unable to rest together. This is a very important point to consider all the way along. So those things which we're going to do later, either together or separately, should be well developed before the time comes. Then the first 5 years after retirement will not be a difficult adjustment period. It will be a period of greater activity in the effort to catch up the time we have wasted trying to make a living. And we may have made the living, but the time is wasted as far as the complete person is concerned. There is nothing but, again, the old problem of the economic dependency with which we have burdened our world for the last several thousands of years. Another very interesting point to consider is that leisure is also the possibility for the advancement of personal skills. The person who has never been skillful in anything will find many opportunities to make use of the complicated mental organism with which he has been endowed. He will find the possibility of creating things, of fashioning with his own hands things that he used to buy. He will then understand why and how a great artist or a great musician attains the virtuosity which we admire. He begins to realize that he can start to play the piano, but there's not much danger of his becoming a Paderewski. But he can play it, and he plays it a little, and he feels in himself that he is a great artist, and his friends have sense enough to let him continue to think so. But a little tune that he has learned himself becomes more important to him than a 100-person orchestra playing Bach, because he's doing it himself. And the process of phoning it off or selling it out or something all the time, which makes up the life of the evasive person trying to run a business, is much less satisfying than the sudden ability to play a simple bit of music with one finger on each hand. It's different because you do it. And in business hours, the things you want to do, you think about. In retirement, the things you want to do, you do. And this sudden development of actual participation in your own thoughts, dreams, hopes, and ideas becomes tremendously valuable and important. From the standpoint of the more mystical approach, the more wisely we live our life here, the closer we come to the universal plan. Because the universal plan had its purpose in putting us here. We were not here to wait to die. We were not here to cheat each other or to talk ourselves or evade ourselves out of facts. We were not even here to permit some religious belief to support false attitudes of our own. We were not here to be a fanatic We were not here to be intolerant. We were not here to do any kind of judging of other people that is detrimental, especially if we do not even know them. We are here to improve the quality of our own integrity. We can be honest without too much insight. We just kind of keep the common rules of life. But to graduate this honesty up to integrity means a conscious dedication to values that are worthwhile. Now, why should we do this? Some people think there is no life after death. Then why should we be great and noble and try to fill our closing years with hard work in the name of growth? Well, if it's true, which I doubt severely, that we do not have any further life, then what we do between 60 and 75 or 80 or 85, while we're still here, makes being here for those years better. Whether there's anything after isn't important at that point. It's to do it now and to get the virtues and values and have them available if they are needed at some future time. Others feel that it is our moral right to rebel against the pressures of society and to become anti-establishmentarians as we get older. Don't do anything useful because other people do it, and it interferes with freedom. Instead of being useful, become an alcoholic. This is one way of getting out of a situation of doing nothing and trying to make it work. Every bit of effort we make is useful when we make it. It is good at the time we make the effort, and the consequences continue to help all through the years ahead. So, assuming that we do have a life afterwards, Socrates brings this up very beautifully in the few moments before his own death, where he says that he is either going to go into another life where he will find the answers to all the questions that he has never been able to answer in this world, or else he will go to sleep and will have no future whatsoever and will never know that he even existed. Those are his ends. But those who persecuted him and unjustly sentenced him to death, he says they are the ones who will suffer, because they will not pass to nothingness. They will have to live with their own conscience for the rest of their lives.